You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU a scientist?
I felt right.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, welcome to The Story Collider, where true personal stories about science help us to discover how weird and wonderful it is to exist in this world and be a human. I'm your host, Misha Gajewski, and today's episode is all about one of the most universal and deeply personal experiences we encounter, facing death. I don't know if you've ever been confronted by your own mortality, but the experience is often filled with fear, uncertainty, and reflection. In this episode, we'll hear two incredible stories from people who face death head on. Our first story is from Brad Lawrence. Brad is a storied producer for the Risk podcast, a storyteller, and solo show performer who has performed to sold-out crowds around the United States and in the UK. His story was recorded in New York at Crane Theater and is a wild ride, literally, in that he was in a plane emergency landing. And oh my gosh, can I just say that I'm glad I've never had to experience that, but I am glad we can all live vicariously through Brad's story. It's so good. Here's Brad.
I am about halfway through a 3-hour flight from New York to St. Louis, where my mother and sister live. And it is drink service, and the flight attendant has gotten to my row, and she has made eye contact with me, and you can see her forming the words, "Would you like something to drink?" when suddenly the plane begins to make this noise. It is like someone firing up a cement cutter inside a steel pipe. It is everywhere at once. It just completely fills the plane, and I turn and look around trying to figure out like where the sound is coming from, and here's a little inside secret. I do not know how planes work. And so I just kind of like, when it starts making the sound, I just kind of think to myself, well, okay, this is a sound that airplanes can make. And then I turn back to the flight attendant, who's a woman in her 40s, clearly a veteran of the airline industry. She has probably heard every sound an airplane can make. And from the stricken, ashen look on her face, I can tell this is not one of them. And she looks at me and she says, "I'll be right back." And then she sort of stands a bolt upright and she walks back up the aisle to the front of the plane and she gets on the phone to the cockpit and she's talking to the cockpit for a bit. And then the other flight attendant joins her up there. And then she toggles off from the cockpit. She toggles back onto the intercom and she says, "Ladies and gentlemen, this airplane has experienced a mechanical issue and we are going to be making an emergency landing. Please return to your seats, fasten your seatbelts, and await instructions." And then it is quiet, aside from this droning noise that is continuing and everybody is just sort of staring ahead. And now Cecily, that's the flight attendant's name, she is back at my row because I am sitting in the emergency exit row. And it is me and like six big dudes and one very small woman. And Cecily repeats the question they ask you when you first get on the plane, and she says, "Do you feel that you can assist in case of an emergency landing, which is going to happen?" And everyone nods for the very small woman who raises her hand, basically admitting that she lied the first time. And so Cecily swaps her out with like a fireman. And then she starts giving us the instructions, right? She takes all of our names, and then she says, "When the plane lands, if you hear me call your name, immediately pop the emergency exit door, the inflatable slide will inflate, begin guiding people to that slide. If the plane lands and you do not hear me call your name, if I am incapacitated, if there is smoke in the cabin, if there is fire in the cabin, immediately open your emergency door, do not wait for a signal, and guide people out onto the slide." And she says, "We're going to try to find a safe place to land. This could be a water landing." We are over Western Pennsylvania. Water landing is what? Are we like talking about like the Allentown public pool? What's the plan? Before I can ask any of this, Cecily has turned around and gone back up towards the front of the cabin. And I look at the kid sitting next to me, who is like, he looks like just like this fresh-faced 19-year-old. He looks like a high school all-star, like high tide haircut. And he's looking at me, and his eyes are huge. And he says, "Water landing? Man, I can't swim." There's a scene in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid where they have to jump off a cliff into a river to escape a posse, and Robert Redford doesn't want to, and Paul Newman as Butch Cassidy says, "What's your problem?" And Robert Redford says, "I can't swim," and Paul Newman says, "Swim? Are you kidding? The fall's gonna kill you." And this is exactly what pops into my head when this kid says, "I can't swim." But I do not say it out loud to this terrified 19-year-old because I am not a monster. Instead, I just sort of asking him questions about who he is and where he's from, why he's going to St. Louis, these kinds of things, trying to sort of, you know, distract him from the impending catastrophe. And then Cecily comes back on, and she says, you know, the pilot's got to make an announcement, and then the pilot's on. And, you know, pilots always sound like they are just like pure confidence, like embodied. They've never been turned down for a date in their lives. Not anymore. Because this pilot comes on and he's like, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are, we've been cleared to, try and make it to the, Pittsburgh airport, and we are gonna try," he keeps saying the word try, "we're gonna try to do that, and, it is 9 minutes away." So now Cecily's gonna take you through the emergency landing protocol. Cecily's back. The emergency landing protocol is this. Cecily and her other flight attendant, they are going to say, bend and brace when the time comes. And your job, our job, everyone on the plane, our job is to like get the top half of our body as close to our knees as possible, grab our knees, and hope for the best. And that's the emergency landing protocol. That's it, right? And so Cecily signs off, and now we have 9 minutes. There is a thin layer of thin smoke in the cabin. It is very quiet. You can hear some people sobbing. You can hear some people hyperventilating, but no one is saying anything. And now it is 9 minutes, and it is time to take stock. It is time to do an inventory, because seeing how these people are reacting, see how this veteran flight crew has reacted to what's happening, I do a little back of the matchbook math in my head, and I figure, okay, based on just this, I think it's about 80%. This is it. And so, time to take some stock. And top of the list, my wife, who's back home in New York. But here's the thing with my wife. I am not a nervous traveler, but I do this thing. Whenever I travel without my wife, I do this thing for like the 4 days leading up to the trip, where I follow her around the apartment going, "I love you. You mean so much to me. You're the most important thing in my life. You've changed my life completely. Everything is, you're just everything to me." And she sort of endures this onslaught because she knows that when I was a kid, my father, a long haul trucker, died on the job out of state. And I grew up on my mother's stories of how hard that was. And so now whenever we travel separately, she just kind of lets me do this. But now that it looks like this might happen, it's actually pretty reassuring because I know she's going to be hurt. I know she's going to be sad, but I actually have done it. I've told her all the stuff, and that is actually very comforting. So, okay. Number two on the list, how do you judge a life lived? Like, am I happy with what I've done? And the best kind of formula I come up with this or with this is, I've been a lot of weird places and did a bunch of weird stuff. And for a kid from Missouri, that's pretty good, actually. That's about as good as it's going to get. And I can accept that. I can live with that or not, however that turns out. I'm satisfied with that. It's okay, fine. Three, what happens after this? If this is it, what comes next? And this is the part where I have to disappoint my mother, who is evangelical, has been waiting many, many decades for something to happen that will bring me back to the loving arms of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And apparently, that's not going to happen because it didn't happen then. just, you know, not even a thought. In the years since I left the church, I've come up with my own sort of ideas and notions about the structure and nature of existence, and I do not know if they are right. I do not discuss them with anyone. One of the reasons I left the church, so I'd never have to discuss them with anyone. But I find in this moment they actually are providing me comfort that I don't know if they're right, but they're good enough for this moment. And that's all I need them to be. So, okay. That's all the big items. And then Cecily's back and Cecily says, bend and brace. We all bend forward. We all grab our knees. And now we are going down. And as we are descending, I am waiting to feel that lift. You know, that lift when you're getting like close to the ground and you can feel the air kind of catch the wings and kind of pull you up right before the plane lands and hits like an actual runway. And I'm waiting to feel that lift and hoping that's what I feel and hoping that if it's not going to be that it's nothing. That like if it's just going to be a nosedive and then blood and fire and explosions, it'll just be quick and I will feel nothing and know nothing and it'll be over and that's all I can hope for. And then as the plane begins to like get like closer to the ground, I feel that lift, and then I hear the squelch of the tires, and then we are down on an actual runway and the plane is slowing to a stop, and the pilot comes on and he goes, "Welcome to Pittsburgh." And we all lean up and we are laughing and cheering, and it is amazing that we are alive. And then we pull into the terminal, and then we all get off the plane and immediately go to a bar and get very drunk. It was a TGI Fridays. We didn't care. And then I had to get back on a plane because, like, now they got us a new plane. We have to get, like, go. And there's no time to develop a phobia. You just got to get back in there. And so we do. And then 3 days later after that, I've got to return to New York. And then 3 weeks past that, I am mad at everything. I am standing in the living room, and I am at this point, I am mad at the printer because it's not the only things I want a printer to do, and I am just cursing at the printer, and it's right next to a window, and I'm thinking about just grabbing it and chucking it out that window onto the sidewalk, and my wife comes in, and she's like, "What is going on with you?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I'm mad at everything, and I don't know why." And she says, "Do you think this is some kind of like PTSD from the near plane crash?" I know less about psychology than I do about airplanes. And my wife and I, neither of us, we don't go in for self-diagnoses, right? I think if things like PTSD and those kinds of things are, if you're going to regard those things as legitimate medical phenomena, then they should be diagnosed by legitimate medical professionals, right? I am not qualified to do that. Neither is anyone on the internet. You know, I'm not going to go in for that kind of thing. But I know that my wife, when she says this, I know that she means this in the colloquial way that we've all learned to abuse these terms, which is as shorthand for, "Hey, buddy, not dealing with something?" And that takes some consideration. And I think about that. And I finally say to her, "Here's the thing. When I thought I was going to die, I thought I handled that well. I was very proud of how I handled that. I was not afraid. I accepted it. I was okay with it. And I was proud of that. But now it is 3 weeks later, and I feel like I handled my potential death so much better than I am handling my actual life." And she said, "Well, of course you are." I said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, death, dying is easy. It's something you do once. Living you have to do every single day." Thank you.
That was Brad. Told you it was going to be a wild ride. To learn more about him, visit our website, storyclatter.org. Being a storyteller on our stage is just one way to make Storyclatter happen, but if standing alone in the spotlight in front of an audience doesn't speak to you, maybe becoming a Storyclatter donor might be more your speed. Storyclatter donors play a vital role in our ability to bring you this podcast. We're in this together. Storyclatter is one big experiment that's designed to connect us around our love of discovery, curiosity, and the natural world. The most popular level is $10 a month, and you can make your tax-deductible donation at storyclatter.org/donate. But really, any level makes a difference, and we're so grateful to everyone who supports Storyclatter. Our next storyteller is Kevin Griffin. Kevin is a scientist in progress who loves to spend time outside, snuggle her little dog, and go to sleep by 9 p.m., something which I deeply respect. Her story was recorded at Kit Recital Hall in Flagstaff, Arizona, for a special show we did in partnership with Northern Arizona University and Writing Class Radio. Her story is such a beautiful story about how even after something devastating, we can heal and make things better. You're going to love it. Here's Kevin.
When I woke up, the bear was watching me. He was standing there about 5 feet away. He'd snuck up on me while I slept, this huge animal. And in the moonlight, I could see his fur glinting this beautiful cinnamon color as he breathed. We stared at each other, my blue eyes, his depthless black ones. And in that moment, I recalled with absolute clarity that humans can be prey. We stared a little longer. It must have only been seconds. And then the moment broke. And the bear turned and ran. He goes thundering down the slope to the trees. I get out of my tent and I go up the hill to where my coworker Wesley is sleeping peacefully. He's missed the whole thing. And I shake him awake and I'm like, Wesley, you will not believe what the hell just happened to me. I'm telling him the story and he goes, how fucking cool, right? I'm like, yeah, it's amazing. And then he goes, were you scared? And I'm like, obviously. I was recalling as I sat there, as I told that to him, that I was scared. You know, I realized even though they tell you sort of your first week in the Sierra Nevada that black bears don't mean you any harm, knowing that didn't really change it in that moment. You know, black bears don't really see you as food. And if you offer them food, they're going to be interested. But for the most part, they're not going to fight you unless something's really wrong, unless circumstances have changed and they've become dangerous. That was my fourth summer in the Sierra Nevada. And my job was as a biological science technician, right? I would hike into these beautiful alpine fens and wet meadows, and I would survey the vegetation there from the smallest moss to the tallest overhanging tree. We would backpack in for 8 days at a time, and we would look at everything, the groundwater, the hydrology. It wasn't always easy, but I loved it. And the job was really an excuse for me to pursue my true passion, which was the place, this kingdom of gnarled pines and granite peaks and blue lakes that were so beautiful, they made my dusty little desert-born heart ache. I saw wonders in the Sierra Nevada, and I know that's corny, but it is absolutely true. One summer, I sat at the top of Half Dome, and I watched the Perseid meteor shower swing by, these stars so close it felt like I could touch them. Another, I sat on the shores of a place called Lake South America, and I watched a golden eagle fly by, his wings longer than I was tall. And sure, there were mosquitoes, lots of mosquitoes, and lightning and hunger. And sometimes Wesley, one of my best friends who I'd known for forever, we would get mad at each other. He'd eat the last piece of chocolate or he'd annoy me that day. And I wrecked my knees and two relationships. And to this day, I cannot eat instant oatmeal without wanting to throw up. Still, it was always worth it, you know, no matter how scary, no matter how hard. So it's maybe unsurprising that about a month after the incident with the bear, Wes and I have hiked into a new ridgeline. We're about 200 miles to the south of where we'd seen the bear. We're in Sequoia National Park, and we're up high, 13,000 feet. We're above treeline, and that night we sit there and we make our ramen, and we're chatting as the sun sets and the stars come out, and they unfold all around us like this beautiful blanket, this tapestry. And it feels like we're at the top of the world. I think to myself how absolutely lucky and how absolutely grateful I am to be there in this place that I love so much and this place that I would spend forever in if I could. And I wake up the next morning and my throat is sore. My eyes are crusted shut. And when I pry them open, I rub them on my sleeve, the sky is brown. The sun is coming up and it's this creepy blood red color. And even though it's like 5:30 in the morning, I already have a headache and I know that this fire is different. I climb out of my tent and Wes is already awake. You know, he couldn't sleep through this one. He's shoving tent poles into his bag and he looks at me and he goes, we need to get out of here. And I say, definitely. And as we're putting our packs back on, he looks at me and he asks, are you scared? And I say, obviously. Wes and I have an 18-mile hike out to our car. We have a 5-hour drive around the southern tip of the Sierra to get back to park headquarters, where we start and end every trip and where all of our belongings are, all of our coworkers. And that entire 18 miles, this day and a half of travel, I'm thinking about how scared I really am. Because the thing about fire in the Sierra is that it shouldn't be scary. It should be a part of the landscape. Like the bear, it's this thing that really only becomes dangerous when circumstances have gone wrong. But in the Sierra, things have changed and things have gone wrong. And these gentle fires that are supposed to help the sequoias open their cones and weed out the weedy trees, they've become something terrifying. And I could see it as we drove into town, this plume of smoke rising out of Kern Canyon, twisting in the light. By the time we got home, the fire had beaten us there. Flakes of ash are falling from the sky, and the air quality index says that things are unhealthy beyond unhealthy. Our boss tells us that we should be ready to evacuate, and Wes and I are. We pack our belongings into our matching beat-up Subarus, and in whatever space is left, our boss starts handing us Tupperware totes full of herbarium specimens, because in case the park burns down, they want to make sure that these rare plant collections are safe. We check the house, we click the lights off, and I stand on the porch looking up at these mountains that had been my favorite home. And I realize I'm not really scared for me. I'm scared for the place. I'm scared for what happens after these massive fires. We post this flyer on the door of the house as we lock it for the incoming firefighters to see that says the occupants of this residence evacuated on 9/16/2020. And we drive away. It's been 3 years now since that fire. And these days, I don't swim in alpine lakes, and I don't commune with black bears, and I don't measure my time by how many months have passed since I was last in the Sierra. What I study now is what comes after. I don't want this to be a story about despair or grief or the loss that I feel watching those mountains burn. I want this to be a story about what grows back. And that's why I'm here, so that I can wake up every day and try to make a tiny piece of this a little bit better. Thank you.
That was Kevin. If you'd like to hear all the stories from that show, head to our friends over at writingclassradio.com. To learn more about Kevin, visit our website, storyclatter.org. Our website is just one way to connect with Story Clutter, but there are so many other ways, and we hope you'll use them all. You can always follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Head to storyclutter.org to become a financial supporter. Or if you want to come to one of our shows, start your own Story Clutter show in your community, or even learn how to tell your own science story, you can learn all about that on our website, too. This podcast is produced by me, Misha Gajewski, along with Nikisha Roberts-Washington, Jen Chen, and Aaron Barker, Executive Director and Co-Founder of The Story Clatter. The stories featured in today's episode were produced by Tracy Segarra, Zach Stovall, Jitesh Jaggi, and Ari Daniel. Special thanks goes out to Story Clatter's board and staff, including Anne-Marie Lonsdale, Lizzie Burnson, and Lindsay Cooper. Our theme music is by Ghost, and next week I'll be back with stories that dive into the weird human experience of imposter syndrome. You don't want to miss them. Until next time, thanks so much for listening.